Du bist auf Osteopathie-Visite mit Klaas und Dennis. Und dieser Podcast heißt Knochenjob.
I guess it was a combination of things. I've always found biological sciences very interesting. I'm an explorer by nature.
Yes, I heard that.
Yeah, and I found in clinical practice, really, I was finding I just did not have the understanding or skills to help the people who seemed to me most in need of help and were on the edges of society, really. And that's the people with persistent pain disorders. So I treated a patient who actually suggested to me, what about you do a PhD and organised a scholarship, and I started. So it was never something I intended to do until I had started.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it was fantastic.
Okay. And is your drive still the same? The drive that you felt or that you experienced, that you explored? Or has it changed within all the years in the scientific field?
That's a really nice question.
I hope so. I have some more for you.
I'm not used to to that one. Has it changed? It probably hasn't changed that much. I have many shortcomings and things I'm not good at, and one of those things is planning ahead.
Okay.
I don't have a big long-term goal related to anything, really. But I'm very clear on what I want now. And what I want now is to enjoy my work, to have my work resonate with my values, and to accommodate the most important things in my life with my work and vice versa. And I'm able to do that. I have a fascinating job. I get paid to keep exploring. I work every day with clever, kind, and community-minded people. I'm part of networks across the world of very high-quality humans, and I love it. So my drive is really to keep doing what I love.
Okay, that's great. And you help a lot of people with it, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, okay. yeah, great. By accomplishing, you want nothing less than a pain revolution, right? This is what I heard from your talks and from your books.
Yeah.
What has helped you the most to accomplish this goal, so to get close to these goals? Was it having scientific background, writing a book, or doing a bike journey through the country, or the field of the community of the physiotherapists? What helped you the most? What groups or what?
Yeah, well, you have touched on everything that seems to be important except one thing, and the one thing you didn't mention is the people who went before me and who encouraged me and who I work alongside. There are some terrific humans that have been driving what is now recognised as a pain revolution from really before I was born. Now, I mentioned Patrick Wall in the talk today, and he said very clearly to me, what physiotherapists don't realise is that they have all the skills to change the way we do things. So he spotted this a long time ago. So some of the things you mentioned have particular advantages. I think that being a scientist with a good understanding of pain sciences gives you credibility arguing about pain sciences, obviously. But you know, you mentioned the network of physiotherapists. Around the world, there are thousands of clinicians, not just physiotherapists, who are slowly pushing this forward and who inform what I do and what a range of other pain scientists do. I'm really excited at the moment about another project that fits alongside the pain revolution, but is captured more broadly by this idea of of clinician as scientist, of encouraging clinicians.
Clinician as a scientist, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Encouraging clinicians to exploit the lovely things that science offers for giving us confidence in decisions we're making, but also being at the data collection, observation and innovation end, and not feeling like there's a group of scientists who don't know what a patient looks like, telling the clinician how to work.
Yeah.
I think that's such a disappointing impression. What we're trying to do is to say to the clinicians, the physios, the psychologists, the doctors, to say, let's work more closely. You tell us, what are the gaps in your knowledge? What are the things that the scientists suggest you should do that work? What doesn't work? What sort of patient is difficult to work out? Can you invent a way of overcoming that? So, you know, that massive community of clinicians who are pursuing the truth and applying contemporary pain science to their practice and learning things and spreading the word, that's a massive resource that from which I benefit and from which the world benefits, for sure.
So this will be the next logic step in the pain revolution, to get both together, clinicians and scientists, and to mix it up.
I think so. I mean, I feel like we're quite integrated in the work that I do, and I still see patients, and that's important for me. Not many, but it's important that I do. I think we're quite integrated. I'm really enjoying at the moment the challenge of expanding those relationships beyond our group and beyond my sphere of influence. It's such an exciting time to be in this space because we can't hold back the tide. It's turned and it's coming in, and now I get more excited about riding it. You know, it's cool.
Okay. And when you think about your goals or your achievements or the pain revolution, what were the biggest obstacles you had to face? You know, people, the pharma lobby or whatever, you told us that you're familiar with them, that you deal with them, or the Pfizer or whatever.
Yeah. And I've done work with a few pharma.
Yeah, but were there any groups or any things that happened that were close to stopping you, where you maybe you thought about throwing everything away or whatever?
We could confine that question to the Pain Revolution Initiative, which, as you know, is an initiative in Australia centred around our flagship outreach tour, fundraising, awareness raising, funding local pain educators, the Local Pain Educator Network. We could talk about that question, about that event, and my answer would be, there have been many massive barriers. And we could also just apply the question to my entire journey. From when I first started getting excited about the science of pain, there have been many barriers to what I would see as progress. But for every barrier, there have been important facilitators and mechanisms of overcoming those barriers. And I guess I would more relate them to keeping authentic, keeping the blinkers on, and saying, well, this is what really looks to be true. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to be distracted by people behaving badly or companies with ulterior motives, because I believe this, some people think this is naive, but I believe that in the end, quality will win.
Mm-hmm.
Honesty will win. We just have to have the skills and patience and support networks to last until it does, to hold the line. So, yeah, there are a lot of barriers, but I would much rather focus on the amazing facilitators, the people who have given massive amount of time, the organisations who give money. The Pain Revolution is very well sponsored by companies that lose money because people are in pain. Not companies that make money for selling treatments.
Yeah.
No, it's a great relationship, and I'm very grateful to those companies.
Good to hear. Yeah. And another little bit personal question. Have you yourself perceived persistent pain, or I think everybody feels pain. But have your own experience with chronic or persistent pain?
Yeah, so I before I became a physiotherapist, I'd had quite a big injury playing football, and I had I had persistent pain late into my 20s. I don't now. I'm not that long ago, maybe 6 years ago, I got diagnosed with a autoimmune polyarthropathy, which I'm no secrets about, but it's very well managed. But sometimes it hurts, for sure. And sometimes I find myself scratching my head to work out, why does it hurt now? Why is my joint swollen this morning? I wasn't swollen last night. What's different? And so I often feel like I imagine some of my patients feel when they say things to me like, but it makes no sense. And I feel that, and I spend my whole life trying to understand the system. So it's a great reminder of the fearful and wonderful complexity of the human. And I think clearly we're all of our journeys are influenced by our experiences, and mine would be no exception to that.
Yeah, that's right. Do you think it helps if a physio has experienced pain himself? If it helps to increase the outcome, the clinical outcome, when he treats the patient? Or do you think it can be a cause of bias? If he thinks, okay, this worked for me, this is supposed to work with you.
That's a really insightful question, because I think the answer to the question from my perspective would be, well, it all depends whether it helps or not. If the physiotherapist has a personal insight, like you say, that might bring empathy and might bring credibility, but it might also run the risk of exactly the same, the thing that you're mentioning. I think there are a lot of treatments out there that the only evidence used to support them is, I had this thing, I did this, and this thing went away. Therefore, I'm packaging what I did like this, and I'm going to sell it. And I think that's highly problematic, and I've very intentionally avoided anything like that. I wasn't prepared to say to anyone that treatment X worked until there was a randomized controlled trial on it. And I think that's really important, actually, because our field has a track record of, and our field being the wide sort of musculoskeletal pain field. We have a track record of selling treatments way before we've really tested them. And most of those treatments, when we really test them, they're marginally or not effective. So I do think that's actually quite important. But I very seldom will tell my story in a clinical interaction. In fact, in any interaction, you know, this will be news to most people, even people who know me quite well. Because I really don't want anyone to think I'm saying anything like that. That I do what I do because I'm convinced that my personal experience will apply to everyone. Because I'm actually convinced that it won't. We all have different resources and frameworks and experiences and learning models and opportunities.
So you really back up what you teach. You do that. You treat yourself with how you would treat other people, or how you recommend other people to treat them.
I think so.
You're looking at the RCTs and all.
I think so.
Wonderful. Now, you've said that you're an explorer. You travel around and explore the countries or the different cultures. When you travel around Europe, especially Germany or the Netherlands, have you experienced something in the culture or in the biopsychosocial surrounding where we live in? What is special about pain? You know, you've always emphasized the biopsychological and the cultural influences on pain, and that maybe it's a different thing in Australia than in Germany. Have you had any experiences like that where you thought, okay,
not really? Yeah, not really. I mean, I do feel like I'm an explorer, but I don't actually explore the ends of the earth very well, because don't have time to, in part, and because I'd rather be exploring things closer to home, and not necessarily as a tourist or anything. But and I'm certainly not well placed to have a deep understanding of the cultural differences between a lot of countries. But in the spirit of your question, I think different countries have different expectations about pain and different treatment approaches and incentives and funding schemes and access to care and language and roles, gender roles or age-related roles. So all of these things I see as being different in different places. But I couldn't say, oh, German people seem very blah. Dutch people seem very blah. I can say that English people seem to apologise a lot. But that's probably, you know, it's just so do Australians, we're quite angry in that sense.
One of my last questions, there's a debate about whether treatment is allowed, mostly a manual treatment, is allowed to be painful to the patient, or it shouldn't be painful at all. Do you have a personal take on this, or do you know about evidence which backs up one side or the other side, or is it all individual?
I'm certainly not I'm certainly not an expert on the evidence in that. I'm not sure how much there is. From a mechanism perspective, I would again say, well, it depends. Depends what the objective is. I think there's so many contextual cues and predicted outcomes and therapists' expectations and patient expectations. All these things are very relevant, I think. There will be some people who feel like you haven't treated them if it hasn't hurt.
That's right.
There'll be other people who think you're crazy if it hurts. And I think it all depends on what you're trying to achieve. But although you didn't really ask this question, one thing that I do think is important and that we have an obligation as clinicians to is our version of maybe the Hippocratic Oath, do no harm, as it applies to how we explain what we do. And I think that if we explain the analgesic effect of a treatment, whether it's painful or not, according to scientific models that have been refuted or evidence against that explanation, and it plants the seed of catastrophic structural implications, I think we're doing harm. And I think we should not do that anymore. So regardless of whether the treatment is painful or not, I think we have an obligation to be accurate and precise in our explanation for any effect that we have. I know that wasn't really a question, but if I get to say that, I always say it.
I love it. It was made sense for me. I think that's about all.
Cool.
Thank you very much
for having me.
Der Knochenjob-Podcast wird gesponsert von der Praxissoftware Lemniscus. Ich bin seit Jahren zufriedener Kunde. Das liegt unter anderem daran, dass mir Lemniscus sehr viel Zeit und auch einiges an Geld eingespart hat. Ich nutze vor allen Dingen die Kalenderfunktion. Dadurch ist es sehr einfach, die Patienten einzuplanen, in verschiedene Spalten einzutragen oder dass diese sich ganz einfach online bei euch einen Termin buchen können und selber die Zeit und den Therapeuten auswählen können. Mit wenigen Klicks ist die Rechnung erstellt und an eure Patienten per E-Mail versendet. Dadurch kommt man dem Traum von einer papierlosen Praxis deutlich näher. Ihr benötigt kein Papier, um die Rechnung auszudrucken oder um diese per Post zu verschicken und spart dabei auch noch Porto. Ebenso könnt ihr unterschiedliche Bezahlungsmodalitäten wählen, egal ob per Rechnung, EC-Karte oder auch bar. Eine Funktion, die ich auch sehr, sehr zu schätzen weiß, ist die automatische Terminerinnerung. Ihr könnt einstellen, wie viele Tage vorher eure Patientinnen und Patienten an den Termin bei euch in der Praxis erinnert werden sollen. Dadurch kam es bei mir zu deutlich weniger Ausfallterminen und zu einer höheren Zufriedenheit bei meinen Patientinnen und Patienten. Falls ihr noch andere Praxis-Software-Lösungen nutzt, ist es auch relativ einfach, die dort vorhandenen Daten bei Lemniscus einzuspielen, so dass es ein ziemlich einfacher Wechsel ist. Lemniscus bietet Praxislösungen an für Solo-Selbstständige. Also wenn ihr nur wenige Patienten im Monat habt, dann ist das für euch auch möglich. Und bereits ab 15 Euro pro Monat erhältlich. Habt ihr eine größere Praxis mit mehreren Mitarbeitern, ist auch das kein Problem. Da könnt ihr ein größeres Paket dazu buchen. Der Knochenjob-Podcast hat durch die Kooperation mit Lemniscus die Möglichkeit, dass ihr davon profitiert und einen Rabatt von 20% auf das erste Jahr bekommt. Der Gutscheincode, den ihr dafür angeben müsst bei der Buchung, ist Knochenjob. Mit dem Gutscheincode Knochenjob bekommt ihr 20% auf das erste Jahr bei der Praxissoftware Lemniscus. Lemniscus mit C.